Atlantis, the Lost Continent, presented by Radio Canada International. This is the final program in our series on Atlantis, which was created, researched, and produced by Robert Zend. In this program, A Theory of Catastrophes.
Once upon a time, in a tiny little village on the eastern ocean shore, lived a fisherman named Okusaki with his young wife and three little children. They were very, very poor. While her husband was out on the sea fishing, Aiko went to the market day by day and sold the catch of the previous day. Yet the money she made, no matter how much her husband caught, was hardly enough to pay the rent and satisfy their frugal needs. One afternoon, while Okusaki rode the quiet waves with his fishing boat, suddenly, without any previous sign, black clouds gathered overhead. Fast winds began to blow, and before he noticed, the boat dashed away from the land so quickly that he couldn't even see the rooftops of his village. Soon the night descended, but Okusaki wasn't afraid that he'd be lost, for the sea and the sky and the sun, moon, and stars had been his friends for a long time, and he knew that with their help, he would find his way home again. So despite the raging storm and the black night, he fell peacefully asleep in the bottom of his boat, wrapping himself in the canvas of its sails. Next morning when he awoke, the sun shone gloriously, and the boat was aground on the beach of an island. Okusaki got out of his boat, walked around the island, and he found it beautiful. Green grass covered its soil. Young forests grew on the tender slopes of its central hill, and colorful flowers scented all the fields. Okusaki raised the mast, stretched out the white sail, and harnessing the light breeze, sped home on the back of the whispering waves. Aiko, with the three children and some of their friends, had been waiting for him on the shores since sunrise, first sobbing and wailing in the dimness of the dawn, but then jumping and dancing and exulting as a white dot appeared on the horizon and grew bigger and bigger. After kissing and hugging his family and friends, Okusaki told them of how the unpredictable gods of the firmament blew his boat far away from the land, beyond the horizon, to show him that magic island. The next day they all sailed together to see the place and decided that they would make it their new home. And in the next few years, more families followed Okusaki and Aiko and their friends, building more and more wooden houses on the slopes of the hill above the fragrant meadows. In the mythologies of the eastern Pacific Islands, there is a word for a sea monster whose size, compared to the biggest whale, is that of the mammoth compared to that of the elephant. It is said that only a few such monsters are left from a previous world age, when all the living creatures had much longer lives than in our age. Gundragandra is the name of this fish. It lives for 800 to 1,000 years, spends most of its time in the farthest depths of the ocean, and likes to crawl in the mud of the bottom. But from time to time, it comes up from the deep to fill its lungs with air and to sleep for 30 to 40 years. As it floats serenely during these sleeping periods, the wind blows seeds of flowers and trees onto its mud-covered back, which in a few years come to look uncannily like a real island. Such a primeval monster was the one on which Okusaki and his friends settled and lived for years, in happiness and wealth. But one morning, when the men had just prepared their boats, and the women had just cooked breakfast, and the children had just dressed for school, the Gundragandra, in the last minutes of a dream, and feeling a strange itching on its back, awoke. It shook its gigantic body, filled its lungs with air, and turning over, dived, cheerfully somersaulting back into the dark depths of the ocean, taking with it the lives of Okusaki and Aiko, and their children, and their friends, and their homes, and their gardens, and their boats, and their richness, and their happiness, and their hopes.
Robert Zinn's short story is only one illustration of the suddenness with which the catastrophe overwhelmed mankind and swallowed an entire civilization with all its hopes and achievements. Stories of the cataclysm are myriad. They suffuse all the world's mythologies. Also numerous are the scientific theories of what actually brought on the disaster. We ask the world's leading Atlantologist, Edgerton Sykes, to sort out the possibilities.
The first possibility is this. In the year 10,000 BC, approximately, a meteorite, which had various names, passed close to the Earth, split up into fragments, and one large portion dropped in to the Atlantic Ocean just off the east coast of America, probably centered roughly near Bermuda, leaving a very large crater of about 2,000 miles diameter. That in itself would have been quite sufficient to have put down Atlantis, and geologically the traces of the crater formed by this and by smaller portions of the meteorite as it broke up are to be found all over the place. There are, I think, 1,400 craters along the American coast known as the Carolina Bays, not very large, up to about a quarter of a mile in diameter, which are related to this disaster. This, I may say, was the basic cause of the story of the Bermuda Triangle, which has been grossly exaggerated and seems to have lost all touch with the reality of the actual events that occurred. Now, the second possibility is that we were struck by a comet. The head of a comet could be the same size as that of a small asteroid, say 2 or 3 miles in diameter, and would be heavy enough to cause just as much damage as the other celestial visitor. Professor Michael Kamienski, the world's most distinguished authority on the comet Halley and comet Wolf, which was named Comet Wolf Kamienski after him, postulated that about BC 10,000, it was possible that Comet Halley had lost its head in a collision with the Earth and had had to go on ever since without its material head. That is quite a possibility, and from the point of view of an onlooker would have appeared very much the same. The third is that envisaged by the Herbiger theory. Hans Herbiger, who put out his theory in 1913, who died in 1931, was an Austrian engineer who worked out a cosmological system based on his engineering knowledge and experience. One of the points he put forward was that in 10,000 BC, our present moon, which was at that time a small planet or planetoid between ourselves and Mars, got too close to the Earth and was picked up by the Earth's gravitational field as a companion. In the process, Most of the outer covering of the moon, that's its topsoil and everything else which would have enabled life to continue on it, was ripped off it and rained down on the Earth. Again, the effects of the disaster would have been very, very much the same as in the previous two cases. At the moment, we have no evidence which enables us to select any one of those three in preference to the two others. All we know is that the date for all three is exactly the same. The results, as far as the Earth was concerned, were exactly the same, but we are not quite certain as yet as to the precise cause.
Plato and some other sources say that the destruction of Atlantis happened in one day and one night. Do you agree with this theory?
I have nothing against it. I read in a scientific journal the other day that the process of turning a star into a nova takes approximately 3 seconds. And that is a disaster on a far vaster scale than Atlantis. If you accept that the disaster was caused by some piece of cosmic material falling into the sea, then the catastrophe would have been almost instantaneous. In other words, it would have taken place within 24 hours. Now, the story of the flood in Genesis refers to 40 days and 40 nights. But the storms that would have arisen after the destruction of Atlantis would have lasted at least 40 days and 40 nights before they quieted down.
The only problem I see with this theory is that one day wouldn't leave enough time for the survivors to escape and diffuse throughout the whole world, like they say that they diffused in Africa and in the American continent, and that's how we know about it. So how do you explain our knowledge and the survivors who gave us this knowledge?
The answer to that, I think, is quite straightforward. The survivors were the people who had some idea of what was happening and took precautions in advance. In other words, at the time of the disaster, Atlantis was engulfed, and the number of survivors from the whole continent was probably not more than a couple of hundred. But in the preceding weeks or months, during which time it became fairly obvious that there was going to be a natural catastrophe of a major nature, tens of thousands of people poured away into Africa, into Europe, into North America, and South America. And those were the survivors whose stories have come down to us by now. But people who were actually on the island when the disaster occurred, and say, if a couple of hundred got away, well, I think they were extremely fortunate. My own personal impression, nobody did. The disaster was too great.
How do you think that the approaching catastrophe was known before it actually happened in one moment?
The signs were fairly obvious as to anybody knowing the slightest thing about astronomy. Don't forget, we were dealing with a catastrophe which was imminent. In other words, within a question of months or something like that, and which was not at a distance of millions of light years. I should imagine that whichever was the cause of the three that I've given, that the court astrologers were pretty well able to forecast the exact date on which it would happen, with, say, at least six months, perhaps further than that, in advance. It would be very difficult not to realize that something was happening from the heavens, because the pattern of the heavens would be changed. You would see lights in the sky, which you didn't have before. You would have thunderstorms. You would have all kinds of unpleasant things happening as forewarnings of the disaster to come.
So, according to this, the flood was the result of the sinking of Atlantis.
The cause, the immediate cause of the flood, was simply this. A meteorite, as I said before, probably a couple of miles, possibly larger in diameter, plunged into the sea at a great speed and from a height of several thousand miles. The shock was enormous, but the splash was terrific. Probably 10,000 cubic miles of water were shot into the air in about a fifth of a second. Well, this water had to go somewhere. And as it was shot in all directions, a lot of it shot across South America, other splashes reached as far as Europe, and the resulting flood went right round the world, in my opinion, and lasted for the 40 days and 40 nights as set down by Noah. I may say Noah's flood story may be prejudiced in some things, but as a factual newspaper account of an unpleasant event, it's extremely good.
It may very well be that, buoyed up by the scientific theories, is Noah's Ark itself, to say nothing of our boat of Okosaki. Princess Marta de Ruspoli, speaking in Tangier, Morocco, has followed the Ark's voyage not only through the pages of Egyptian mythology, but virtually over the muddy back of the Atlas Mountains to its final resting place.
If there was a huge flood, this flood, according to the Egyptian texts, was a tidal wave. The tidal wave was probably brought about by the enormous earthquakes that took place. Well, this tidal wave was called Aatep in Egyptian hieroglyphs. The wicked back of Aatep was certainly the waves at the tidal wave. The survivors of Atlantis fled in whatever boats they could find. And among these boats, there was certainly a big boat. That boat was the ancestor of the boat of the sun. It was the boat that left Amentet, the sunken island, going towards the continent, where it was swept away by, swept towards the continent by the tidal wave. Well, when the ark of the Egyptian, the boat of Keper, it is called by the Egyptians, that is, the boat of the creator. Keper means to create in Egyptian. Keper. And this boat was flung on and grounded on a staircase, that is the Egyptian legend. So I said to myself, this staircase probably has left some traces somewhere because it must have been a very big staircase. Well, I succeeded in convincing some friends to go with me and have a look and see whether we could find the staircase on Mount Serwa. Well, that was very much of an expedition because Mount Serwa is extremely wild and difficult to get at. In the first place, it snowed up for many months a year, and the snow hardly perhaps melts in the summer. It's over 3,500 meters high. And it is completely wild. It's a kind of no man's land as far as civilization is concerned. But I felt that if I didn't get a coup, all my theories were no good. So I succeeded in getting there. I got there with friends. We had great, great difficulties. There had been floods. The roads were swept away. There were stones. We had to abandon the car. It was a car that, it was a Land Rover that was supposed to go over all sorts of tracks. But even so, it became impossible, and most of the time we had to walk. So we got to a place called Ashkaun, where there was a sheikh, and there were some Moroccan soldiers. And by that time, my friends who had come that far didn't believe in the staircase anymore, and I could see that they had very discouraged faces. So I went up to the sheikh, and I said to him, there's a little question I would like to ask. You see, the Sirwa over there, we can see it on the horizon. And I think that towards the west, facing the setting sun and the valley of the Sous, there must be some rocks that perhaps look a little bit like a staircase. So he looked at me and he said, Madame, you're talking about the geological staircase of Mount Sirwa, one of the most extraordinary marvels of the Atlas, the giant steps. There they were. So you see, the theory was built on something.
We spoke of the Herbiger theory, according to which external celestial events, like the capturing of the moon within the Earth's gravitational field, precipitate a catastrophe. To Herbiger, it is these external catastrophes which terminate each Earth age. The most significant support for this idea has come from the work of Dr. Emmanuel Velikovsky, author of two vastly controversial books, Worlds in Collision and Ages in Chaos.
First, I have to say what are the central theory of my work, or central idea. The central idea is that in historical times, also prehistoric times, also pre-human times, this Earth of ours was not ever an abode of peaceful existence. It was so that in middle of the second millennium BC, the Earth underwent catastrophic encounter with another celestial body, which I identify in my first book, Worlds in Collision. A second series of disturbance came in the time of the great Hebrew prophets, 8th century BC. Human implications are very many in every respect. We have to consider that those catastrophes have left deep wounds in human soul. Nobody today can claim not to be a descendant of survivors of those catastrophes.
It is an established fact that the most terrifying events of childhood are often forgotten, their memory blotted out from consciousness and displaced into the unconscious mind, where they continue to live and to express themselves in bizarre forms of fear. One of the most terrifying events in the past of mankind was the conflagration of the world, accompanied by awful apparitions in the sky, quaking of the earth, vomiting of lava by thousands of volcanoes, melting of the ground, boiling of the sea, submersion of continents, a primeval chaos bombarded by flying hot stones, the roaring of the cleft earth, and the loud hissing of tornadoes of cinders. There occurred more than one world conflagration. The memory of the cataclysms was erased not because of lack of written traditions, but because of some characteristic process that later caused entire nations, together with their literate men, to read into these traditions allegories or metaphors where actually cosmic disturbances were clearly described. It is a psychological phenomenon in the life of individuals as well as whole nations that the most terrifying events of the past may be forgotten or displaced into the subconscious mind, as if obliterated are impressions that should be unforgettable. To uncover their vestiges and their distorted equivalents in the physical life of peoples is a task not unlike that of overcoming amnesia in a single person.
Elsewhere in Worlds in Collision, Dr. Velikovsky writes, in the annals of ancient Etruria were records of seven elapsed ages. Censorinus, an author of the third Christian century, wrote that men thought that different prodigies appeared by means of which the gods notified mortals at the end of each age. The Etruscans were versed in the science of the stars, and after having observed the prodigies with attention, they recorded these observations in their books. The Greeks had similar traditions. There is a period, wrote Censorinus, called the Supreme Year by Aristotle, at the end of which the sun, moon, and all the planets return to their original position. This supreme year has a great winter, called by the Greeks Cataclysmos, which means deluge, and a great summer, called by the Greeks Ekpyrosis, or combustion of the world. The world actually seems to be inundated and burned alternately in each of these epochs. Similar traditions of four expired ages persist on the shores of the Bengal Sea and in the highland of Tibet. The present age is the fifth. The sacred Hindu book Bhagavata Purana tells of four ages and of pralayas or cataclysms in which, in various epochs, mankind was nearly destroyed. The fifth age is that of the present. The world ages are called kalpas or yugas. Each world age met its destruction in catastrophes of conflagration, flood, and hurricane. Azur Vedam and Bhagavedam, sacred Hindu books, keeping to the scheme of four expired ages, differed only in the number of years ascribed to each. In the chapter World Cycles, in Visuddhi Magga, it is said that there are three destructions: the destruction by water, the destruction by fire, the destruction by wind. But that there are seven ages, each of which is separated from the previous one by a world catastrophe. Reference to ages and catastrophes is found in Avesta, Zendavesta, the sacred scriptures of Mazdaism, the ancient religion of the Persians. Bahman Yast, one of the books of Avesta, counts seven world ages or millennia. Zarathustra, Zoroaster, the prophet of Mazdaism, speaks of the signs, wonders, and perplexity which are manifested in the world at the end of each millennium. The Chinese called the perished ages keys, and number 10 keys from the beginning of the world until Confucius. In the ancient Chinese encyclopedia Sing Li Ta Tsuen Chu, the general convulsions of nature are discussed. Because of the periodicity of these convulsions, the span of time between two catastrophes is regarded as a great year. As during a year, so during a world age, the cosmic mechanism winds itself up, and in general convulsion of nature, the sea is carried out of its bed, mountains spring out of the ground, rivers change their course, human beings and everything are ruined, and the ancient traces effaced. In the chronicles of the Mexican kingdom, it is said, the ancients knew that before the present sky and earth were formed, man was already created, and life had manifested itself four times. A tradition of successive creations and catastrophes is found in the Pacific, on Hawaii, and on the islands of Polynesia. There were nine ages, and in each, a different sky was above the earth. Icelanders, too, believed that nine worlds went down in a succession of ages, a tradition that is contained in the Edda. The rabbinical conception of ages crystallized in the post-exilic period. Already before the birth of our earth, worlds had been shaped and brought into existence, only to be destroyed in time. He made several worlds before ours, but he destroyed them all. This earth, too, was not created at the beginning to satisfy the divine plan. It underwent reshaping, six consecutive remoldings. New conditions were created after each of the catastrophes. On the fourth earth lived the generation of the Tower of Babel. We belong to the seventh age, and like the others, it is separated from the foregoing by abyss, chaos, and water. Great catastrophes changed the face of the earth. Some perished by deluge, others were consumed by conflagration, wrote the Jewish philosopher Philo. According to the rabbinical authority, Rashi, ancient tradition knows of periodic collapses of the firmament, one of which occurred in the days of the deluge, and which repeated themselves at intervals of 1,656 years.
the founders of geological science.
Emmanuel Velikovsky.
Like Professor Buckland and Murchison. Those who gave the names to the periods, like Permian period or Ordovician period and Cretaceous period and so on. They were clearly under the impression, and so they professed also, that the Earth underwent a series of geological upheavals on global scale. And it was only under the influence of a lawyer turned geologist, Lyell, Charles Lyell, in the first part of the 19th century, that the view of uniformitarianism, which means gradualism or even no change in the natural history through millennia or through even millions of years. Actually, they followed a statute of faith that what is not happening today could not have happened in the past. If, according to this, I could say that if there is no nova, no exploding star today in the sky, there was no exploding star ever. This view nobody would entertain. Nevertheless, the view of gradualism or uniformitarianism is dominant even today.
To support his theory that it is tumultuous change and not gradual evolution that is the norm for the cosmos, Velikovsky looks to the atom. He writes, "The solar system is actually built like an atom. Only in keeping with the smallness of the atom, the jumping of electrons from one orbit to another when hit by the energy of a photon takes place many times a second, whereas in accord with the vastness of the solar system, a similar phenomenon occurs once in hundreds or thousands of years. In the middle of the second millennium before the present era, the terrestrial globe experienced two displacements, and in the 8th or 7th century before the present era, it experienced three or four more. In the period between, Mars and Venus and the Moon also shifted. If the activity in an atom constitutes a rule for the macrocosm, then the events I have described were not merely accidents of celestial traffic, but normal phenomena like birth and death. A scientific theory in which catastrophes succeed one another, in which fire and cataclysm alternate, finds resonance in a particular view of history. Here is John Michel, author of The View Over Atlantis.
As if there's always been a memory of a cycle of civilization. The story of Atlantis does, after all, belong to the cyclical view of history, according to which civilizations start from nomadic origins in the first settlements and become more and more elaborate and eventually onerous and finally lose contact, as it were, with the earth and rely so heavily on technology that they bring their own destruction. This is what Plato is describing in the Atlantis story. Elsewhere in his works, he refers to the cyclical view of history, by which civilizations arise, become more elaborate, more degenerate, and finally either come to an end by a catastrophe they've made themselves or by destruction by the people inside them. I've always been drawn to a view of history which at the moment is different from the orthodox one. The linear evolutionary pattern of history is the one of present orthodox. And Plato's cyclical view of history contradicts that. The idea that civilizations might have risen and fallen in the past rather tends to destroy the self-confidence of the present one. When I was at Cambridge as a student, the rationalistic view of everything was very much in ascendancy. And mysticism, or any mystical view, or any even traditional view. Was hardly considered at all. Atlantis, or Babylon, the fall of Babylon, destruction of Atlantis, are universal themes. That is, as long as there are people, these stories seem to exist, as it were, autonomously. And however much one may rationalize them or dispute their actual truth, they'll still remain as long as there are people. It's the same as the idea of the millennium, of the promised coming of the perfect kingdom, which in sacred history is preceded by the destruction of the degenerate, over-elaborate former kingdom. It's the fall of Babylon. And psychiatrists and other historians have tried to explain, rationalize, and denigrate these stories. But they can't be exterminated, and since they can't be exterminated, they appear to be eternal in human nature. They should form part of history.
According to Michel, there may be a spiritual theory of catastrophe just as real as any physical one.
As we find the same scientific principles everywhere in the world, so we find the same philosophical ones. The cyclical view of life with reincarnation, the return of life, the recognition of spirit, the recognition of another world alongside ours. These are universal themes, and they indicate a form of universal philosophy. The ancient world had a standard or canon of philosophy, of which Plato said that as long as this standard was observed, so long the civilizations lasted at their height. And when they were no longer observed, the civilizations decayed and collapsed. And he illustrates this with the story of Atlantis. Plato speaks of the standard or canon of the Egyptians by which they kept their civilization stable and at its peak for, he says, 10,000 years. And in his story of Atlantis, he refers to the degeneration of the Atlanteans and their growing materialism and their neglect of the old standard and of their consequent decline. And it does seem from research into the nature of this standard, which was in essence a standard of proportion and harmony, that it was universal.
The invisible empire of the eternal Atlantis will rise again, reclothed with its former power, in the presence of a stupefied humanity on the brink of the abyss. That's from a Rosicrucian book called The Invisible Empire. Its author, Raymond Bernard, is the Amorc Order's supreme legate for Europe and the Grand Master for all French-speaking countries.
My opinion is given through the book, and also I gave all the explanations I felt true through my own meditations or knowledge, personal knowledge. Now I can say about the continent that I agree with many writers, many good, serious writers, that the continent existed 10,000 years ago. I shall say that the civilization was very high. Of course, it was not exactly the same as the civilization we experience now, but the civilization was higher than the present one, still, in my opinion. However, with the same kind of development, materialistic development. Also, with more than that, I think that Atlanteans had a knowledge, a superior knowledge, that we begin to have now, for instance, or that scientists
are beginning to be interested in by now. For instance, in the parapsychological field. But also, at their time, they had another kind of aeroplanes, I could say, but not at all the same kind we have now, maybe more elaborate. Therefore, we can say that certainly at this time, they had distractions such as trips, maybe movies, maybe films, certainly also dancing and so on, you see. But these distractions were met by people who were more educated, yet more educated than we are now. And therefore, these people got distractions from these similar points, similar distractions at a higher level. Music also, naturally. Now, we can understand through all what is said about Atlantis, we can understand that the level of knowledge was very high. Therefore, what we have now as accomplishment on the material plane was certainly, surely, higher in the same proportion. And our civilization is certainly very much developed, but not yet as Atlantis was, and certainly not yet as the future will be. I must add, if people are wise, and if they don't destroy themselves, this would mean the end of Atlantis. And you know about Francis Bacon. He wrote The New Atlantis by forcing the future, that is, what we Atlantis emerging, if I could say.
It's not unusual in esoteric philosophies to find predictions of the eventual rise of Atlantis from the ocean floor. Seen from the perspective of Velikovsky or Herbiger, such a convulsion is little more than part of the continual shifting of the Earth's face, a movement from crest to trough in a cosmic wave of events. But few, if any, psychics have matched the precision of Edgar Cayce, known as the Sleeping Prophet, in detailing the coming Earth changes. Here, from a trance reading he gave in 1943, are some of the things he told us to expect in our time.
As to the changes physical again, the Earth will be broken up in the western portion of America. The greater portion of Japan must go into the sea. The upper portion of Europe will be changed as in the twinkling of an eye. Land will appear off the east coast of America. There will be upheavals in the Arctic and in the Antarctic that will make for the eruption of volcanoes in the torrid areas. And there will be the shifting, then, of the poles, so that where there have been those of a frigid or semi-tropical will become the more tropical, and moss and fern will grow. As to conditions in the geography of the world of the country, changes here are gradually coming about. Many portions of the east coast will be disturbed, as well as many portions of the west coast, as well as the central portion of the United States. In the next few years, lands will appear in the Atlantic as well as in the Pacific, and what is the coastline now of many a land will be bed of the ocean. Then the area where the entity is now located, Virginia Beach, will be among the safety lands, as will be portions of what is now Ohio, Indiana, and Illinois, and much of the southern portion of Canada and the eastern portion of Canada, while the western land, much of that is to be disturbed in this land, as, of course, much in other lands. The earth will be broken up in many places. The early portion will see a change in the physical aspect of the west coast of America. There will be open waters in the northern portion of Greenland. There will be new lands seen off the Caribbean Sea, and dry land will appear. South America shall be shaken from the uppermost portion to the end. And in the Antarctic, off Tierra del Fuego, land and a strait with rushing waters.
The earth and its continents rises and falls. There are fish fossils on the top of the Himalayas, and what was farmland lies on the ocean floor, but only until the next comet or meteor or catastrophe. This much is already suggested by our science, that there are no such things as continents and oceans, only the shifting grimace of the Earth's face. Each changing appearance, seen in this way, is simply the reincarnation of an earlier world. It may not be a great distance from this realization to an understanding of human reincarnation. It was in Edgar Cayce's Life Readings on Reincarnation that Atlantis was first mentioned. Here's his son, Hugh Lynn Cayce.
Yes, there's a whole theory in the Edgar Cayce readings of man's projection or the soul as a spiritual being quite different and separate from the earth, and of the soul projecting into the mineral, plant, and animal form, and that even in Atlantis, there were periods when they were still freeing the body of the crossbreeding and appendages that were related to this projection of the soul into matter. He has many of these descriptions of the early incarnations into the Atlantis, and you were quite right in saying that this was one of the earliest points of man's expression in the earth, though he indicated that there were five of these very early periods of the soul's projecting into matter, so to speak, into plant, mineral, and animal kingdom, and beginning to try to influence it. And then the patterning of what he called thought forms that were quite different from the soul itself, but a form that the soul was using, and that it crossed with the animals, and there was utter chaos in the earth in these early, very early periods. This is in many ways indicated in the legends of people all over the world.
Many other psychics have purported to be able to describe their own and others' past incarnations on Atlantis. In one such session, recorded at the Mind Institute in Toronto, the psychic, Michael Blake Reed, was given the names, while in trance, of those who wished to know of their Atlantean lives. We should say that we make no judgment on the validity of these readings, but listen for yourself.
This one was here a maker of floors, decorative flooring, of that style which was eventually called mosaic. Did manufacture floors of intricate design. And here the oftentimes floors 200 feet by 600 feet were done by herself and assistants of great and most delicate beauty. One worked on the floors, and this one worked on the ceiling. This one did work on the laying of metals upon ceiling structures. Gilting, yeah. Though gilt was not used, we see sheeted was used. And this one did work very well in the forming of metals, especially those thinner sheet metals, almost yet not quite close to being foils. did do much here. With extremely high temperatures of metal. And did virtually melt metals into stone.
Can you more for me?
Memorist. This one here had the ability of memory and did have at his fingertips of his mind vast blocks of memory. You see, while there was here a degree of universal education, there was not here the great need for placing material in written form, though much was done in this area. Much was done as memory. And this one did have a prodigious memory. Especially in here, affairs of state. And this one was a politician with a good memory. Excellent memory. This one with plants, especially in those herbal remedies to aid the body. Especially these were used in the cleansing processes of the body and into the maintenance of the health of the body, not the repairing of those things sickly with the body. This one did work with those states of maintaining health.
Whether or not we lived on Atlantis in a past life, the science of Velikovsky and others tell us that we do live on an Atlantis, or Gundragandra of our story, that is ever present. Our fascination with its past destruction is part of a wish to know our own future destruction. And so, the magic of Atlantis is not only a key to the past, to the cradle of mankind, but also to our own world.
A century from today, we will be antique. 2 centuries, we will be archaic. 5 centuries, we will be dark ages. 10 centuries, we will be ancient history. 2 millennia, we will be prehistoric times. 5 millennia, we won't be remembered. 10 millennia, there won't be who'd remember. We lived long ago.
This program ends our series on Atlantis, which was created and produced by Robert Zend, with co-production and direction by Tim Wilson and Len Shear for Radio Canada International. Len Shear for Radio Canada International.